Hi, I'm Chris Brennan, and you're listening to the Astrology Podcast. Today is Tuesday, August 6th, 2013, and this is the 10th episode of the show. You can find the show at theastrologypodcast.com, and you can also search for us on iTunes. My co-host today is astrologer Austin Coppock, and his website is austincoppock.com. Our topic today will be the future of astrology and talking about some future trends that we see happening in the next few decades. Before we get to the main topic, I just wanted to touch upon a few pieces of astrological news. The first is that The Mountain Astrologer has actually been picked up this month by the grocery store chain Whole Foods. And if you go to, I think, just about any Whole Foods in North America right now, you'll find the latest issue of The Mountain Astrologer magazine there at that store. So this is actually a great thing because it increases their distribution hugely to hundreds or thousands of additional stores across the U.S., and it would definitely be a good idea if other astrologers could help to encourage them to make this a regular thing. So you should probably go out and buy issues of The Mountain Astrologer at Whole Foods if you'd like to see them pick it up more regularly. In other news, related to one of the last podcasts I did with Kelly Surtees, where we talked about Mercury retrograde, at one point we discussed Edward Snowden and briefly mentioned, I think at that point, that he'd been sitting in the airport in Russia for about a week, and that was during the middle of the Mercury retrograde. Interestingly enough, the retrograde ended, and he started to finally sort of wrap that situation up, and then eventually by the end of the Mercury shadow period, just within days of the end of the shadow period, he finally, I guess, was granted asylum for a year in Russia. So that's actually a really excellent example of Mercury retrograde and Mercury retrograde shadow periods to look into. If you look at both the start date of when he officially was outed by the Guardian as the source for their stories, or when he was first announced as the source of their stories, which took place at the beginning of the Mercury shadow period before the retrograde, and then eventually he was granted asylum in Russia at the end of the shadow period. So check that out. And the last or third piece of news is that the NCGR is hosting their major conference in Philadelphia next week, from August 15th through the 19th. And that's actually going to be the biggest conference, the biggest astrology conference of the year. So I'll be there, and I'm doing a lecture and a post-conference workshop on a timing technique known as zodiac releasing. And there's lots of other people that will be there, including my friend Austin Coppock, who is here as, I think this is the first time you've been on the show. So Austin, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Chris.
Yeah, so Austin is the president of the Association for Young Astrologers, so I thought that he would actually be a great person to talk to about this topic that I've been meaning to discuss on the show for some time, which is, what is the future of astrology? Where is astrology headed? And what kind of things might we anticipate, or what might the astrological community look like in future decades, let's say later in this century at some point? So that's the access point. So Austin, why don't you tell us a little bit first about your organization, about the Association for Young Astrologers?
All right, Chris. Well, I wouldn't say it's my organization. You know, I'm sort of entrusted with it at this period, but the AYA, or the Association for Young Astrologers, has been around since 2004. And basically, we're here to sort of to help bridge young people who are interested in astrology, to help connect them to what's going on in the astrological world, to help orient them. And although we have a special focus on young people, some people can be, we can say, young to astrology. You know, if you're 35 and you're just getting serious about it, we have just as much to offer you as if you're 15. And so, you know, we have a couple different ways that we carry out this mission right now. One of them is that we have kind of a treasure trove of lectures that astrologers have donated to us, which are free to members. So we've got people like Demetra George and Stephen Forrest And several other, the late Robert Blaschke, really excellent astrologers who donated hours and hours of material to our members, which is great. And I would note that we've got material from a lot of different sub-traditions within astrology. It's not all traditional or all, therapeutic. So that's one of the ways that we carry out our mission. Another, it's very simple but very important, is that we help, we organize room shares to help get people to conferences who wouldn't otherwise be able to afford it. I think that everybody's pretty clear on how limiting financial factors can be in America right now. The difference between paying $30 or $40 a night for a hotel room and paying $160 is make or break for a lot of folks. And so the AUA has been doing that for a long time. We've got a room share organized for NCGR coming up. We have a couple other projects on the horizon. In terms of connecting people who are getting into astrology, we have a reboot of the website coming up, which will have social network and chat functionality, so people can connect to other people who are getting into astrology. And we'd like to help facilitate sort of mentor relationships as well. And finally, we hope to publish our first yearly journal before the AYA's 10th birthday next March.
Oh, yeah. What, it has a cute name as well, doesn't it?
Yeah. Right now, the working title is Ascendant.
Oh, yeah. That's great. I'm a fan of double entendres like that.
Good, good. Very well, good. If it's not too cheesy. I like
it. No, it's perfect. Ascendant. That's good. Okay. Well, so that's the Association for Young Astrologers. And you guys are actually doing I guess we'll talk about this more later in the show, but you're also doing a pre-conference workshop. The organization is actually organizing it for the day before the NCGR conference starts in Philadelphia, correct?
Absolutely. And I should point out that NCGR was kind enough to offer us this space. And so it's a little different from the other workshops. We've got 3 hours, and I couldn't think of a way. I didn't feel right about handing it to one person. I wanted to showcase some talent and a variety of good ideas. And so we actually divided the time among four people that are going to be covering very different topics.
Okay.
We've got Jen Zart, who's going to be covering the really a forgotten bloom of astrology in the Weimar Republic in Germany, which is basically up till the 30s when things go bad. And Jen is, although somewhat new to the astrological community, actually got her PhD in that period of German history. So she knows a thing or two about it.
Sure.
We've also got Wonder Bright, who's going to be discussing the soul in astrology, but from a different angle than most people are used to. She's going to be discussing the concepts and understanding of the soul from the Hellenistic era and how they might have approached the question of the soul in the chart, which I think is really interesting. And then Rebecca Crane, who's been a therapist for some years, is going to share some of her insights into relationship astrology, sort of building off of the traditional synastry material we've all encountered, but adding to that her working experience as a therapist. And then finally, Eric Pride, who is both an astrologer and identifies as a pagan and I believe a witch, will be talking about some of the overlay historical and practical overlaps between astrology and various magical traditions. So I think it's going to be really interesting.
Excellent. Well, yeah, that sounds like a pretty good cross-section of some of the different, some of the major themes that you see going on in the astrological community today in terms of where things are headed and what people are interested in or focused on.
I hope so. That was my intent.
Sure. Okay, well, that then provides us with a good segue into our topic, which is Where is astrology headed for in the future, and what is the future of astrology? So what do you see as some of the main themes in terms of coming generations, or in terms of where astrology is headed right now? Where do you see astrology in, let's say, 10 years or 20 years?
Yeah, that's a huge question.
Yeah, minor question. Yeah. You have two minutes to answer that.
Well, you know, as an astrologer, I'm working with a lot of traditional technique. I'm actually asked about the future pretty often.
Nick Degenbest always makes that joke. He always says, if only there was some tool or technique that could tell us information about what was happening in the future. But
what I do first is I try to look very clearly at the present, right? Because there are often disruptive factors that kind of change the trajectory of things. But you can see most of the future in the present.
Sure.
And so it's true on a personal as well as a cultural level. And so I guess one of the things I see right now is that astrology is in this place where we're dealing with the past in an unprecedented way. And I don't simply mean what is now being called traditional astrology, but it's sort of like if we just look back from here, if we look back from 2013, we have the entire 20th century of innovation and aberration in astrology, where we've got the emergence of humanistic and later a psychoanalytic astrology. We have the advent of evolutionary astrology. Earlier in the 20th century, we have the Uranian astrology. And in addition, we've also very recently been almost buried in a sort of tidal wave of translations. We have more access to the deeper past as well. And I think right now the astrological community as a whole is in a very confusing place of trying to assimilate this glut of material.
Yeah, definitely. There's been this huge revival of traditional astrology. There's been, starting in the late 80s, I was talking to Kenneth Johnson during the last episode about the revival, or the, not revival because it never existed, but the excitement surrounding Indian astrology starting in the late 80s and early 90s, and how that's become a major tradition in the West. And then even more recently is the advent of a more modern school, which is the evolutionary astrologers, which I'm finding are very well organized, and there seems to be quite a lot of them. There's a lot of people who identify themselves as evolutionary astrologers at this point.
So just as a personal observation, since I assume the role of the president of the AYA, I've sort of become a magnet for conversations about what are the kids into, and as well as talking to the kids.
Sure.
People are like, I've been meeting and talking to a lot of people who are just really getting into astrology, and what I've observed is mostly, I ask, what are you interested in? Do you have any particular subfield that you're interested in? And I hear a lot of evolutionary astrology, and I hear a lot of traditional.
Sure.
An interesting bifurcation.
Yeah, definitely. And also sometimes it's unfortunate, but sometimes people tend to, whatever like system that they first find, or whatever like good book they first pick up or are recommended when they first get into astrology, sometimes that tends to be the line of thinking that they tend to stick with. I've noticed sometimes as well that sometimes it can be more difficult to break out of a certain approach or a certain system once that's what you sort of learned. That's how you learned astrology, and that's how you conceptualize what astrology can do and what it is. Have you noticed that?
Absolutely. And I think there's a very sympathetic reason behind that. If you've ever gone through a point in your practice where I don't want to say switched traditions, but probably tried to incorporate a lot of material that was foreign. I'm thinking of myself, I don't know, maybe 7 years ago when I was first exposed to Hellenistic astrology. Project Hindsight. I was pretty thoroughly schooled in the modern at that point. I had a little bit of exposure to Vedic astrology, but it kind of broke my brain, because it problematized all of these assumptions that I had, and I would say for the better at this point. But I guess I see to a certain degree, if somebody teaches you or you get to a point in your own self's personal study where you can do astrology, you can sit down with a chart and a person and make something happen. It's almost like a delicately crafted machine, like some sort of Antikythera mechanism. Mm-hmm. And to really incorporate new material, you have to take it apart, right? Which means that for a little while, you're not going to be able to use it. And so I sympathize with people's resistance to change, but I think at this point in, you know, in sort of the history of astrology, we've really, those of us who, I guess, feel a duty or an obligation to take on what's happening in astrology in earnest, and kind of have to accept that we're going to have to keep taking apart our machine and putting it back together.
Sure. Yeah, a couple of episodes ago, Kelly Surtees described her process of having to transition to a new house system as almost like having a sex change. It was such a major transition for her that, that's one way of describing, I guess, how serious sometimes it is for people once you've, you know, adopted a certain approach to astrology and you start conceptualizing your own chart and indeed your own life in that way. That sometimes changing that can be pretty major, pretty important. So, So I guess we've talked a little bit about some of the current trends right now are things like revival of traditional astrology, interest in Indian astrology. We have this sort of weird, not weird branch, but this branch of modern astrology that has its own philosophy and some of its own techniques, which is the evolutionary astrologers, and that seems to be one of the modern schools that's doing best right now, although they're dealing with some of their own internal issues in terms of having a split between evidently one school that follows Stephen Forrest and one that follows Jeff Green. I guess we don't need to get into that right now, but so that's a major school. And then we have some of the other schools that were what I feel like were more popular and seemed like they were more upcoming even two or three decades ago, like Uranian astrology, for example, which don't seem to be quite as necessarily like on everybody's lips at the moment. What's your perspective on that?
Well, I've got a few comments regarding evolutionary astrology. Is the split that you spoke of, is it philosophical in nature? If so, that might be worth talking about. If it's something else, we probably don't need to get into it.
Yeah, I think it has to do with like personal issues and allegiances to teachers and stuff like that.
Well, let's leave that alone then.
Yeah, let's skip over that.
I'm not sure where exactly to begin. So one thing I think is interesting about evolutionary astrology, as I understand it, I'm not, I've been exposed to a lot of it, but I wouldn't say it's been a focus for my practice, but I've spoken with some of the major proponents and practitioners, is that the focus is on, understanding the soul, right? And understanding what baggage or gifts the soul might be saddled with. They use the language, most of them that I've spoken to use the language of karma, mm-hmm. right? So we're looking primarily at past life karma, right? There's there's a big difference between the karma generated in this life and the karma generated in a previous life that one experiences in this life, right? Like karma in this life is I don't pay the electricity bill and the electricity stops being pumped into my house. But I don't think that's the focus, right?
I mean, it sounds like they have some technical disagreements. Like one school really emphasizes Pluto and the point opposite to Pluto and the nodes and the rulers of the nodes. And another school has less technical distinctions. And there may be some philosophical disagreements, although I'm under the impression that the main draw of evolutionary astrology is the premise that you can look at the birth chart and say something about a person's past life, past lives, and that's the main draw of that school.
And I think ideally those comments about past lives are things that are directly relevant in this life, right? Like it's an unresolved, it's almost like, so if we're talking about where did the energy that is currently behind evolutionary astrology come from? It's besides Jeff Green's sort of solo revelations, which explains why he got into it, but not why anybody else did, right? Mm-hmm. You know, I think you have the depth, like the merger of astrology and depth psychology, which I suppose is best represented by Liz Green.
Sure.
You know, that lays a precedent for, you know, deep sort of using astrology as a lens or sort of a microscope with which to examine, you know, tiny, you know, the hidden details of the psyche or what's going on within a person, right?
Sure.
And so, you know, in a sense, you know, and so the psychoanalytic method, it often goes back to the past to concealed traumas or, you know, negative self-beliefs in order to unearth them and then correct them, right? And so in some ways, it seems not, it seems like a logical sort of movement in the same direction to go back deeper and go, you know, to things which didn't even happen in this life to expose those traumas and hopefully correct them. And so I think that might be, I think that the psychoanalytic depth psychology or depth astrology might have sort of dug a tunnel, which the evolutionary astrologers dug a little deeper. And then I also wonder about the, like, as you mentioned earlier, the sort of introduction of Vedic astrology to American audiences, to American astrologers. Because there is, the word karma is Sanskrit. And there is a, you know, you can't separate Vedic astrology from Hinduism. And karma is a very important mechanic of reality in Hinduism. And so, you know, I think the combination of a greater karmic focus with this sort of psychoanalytic depth tradition might have laid the ground for evolutionary astrology. I don't know, does that make sense?
Yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense to contextualize the emergence of evolutionary astrology and the interest that it's drawn as like this confluence between two different traditions where you have the earlier sort of New Age tradition on the one hand that comes down from like the Theosophists and the interest in spiritualism that began in the 19th century and then sort of gets filtered down through Alan Leo and Rudyard and Mark Edmund Jones. So you have this interest in karma and reincarnation and sort of like a spiritualistic view of astrology. But then you get this other thread starting in the 60s and 70s and 80s of this push towards a psychological astrology that incorporates some of the insights from depth psychology. So definitely viewing evolutionary astrology as a result of those two threads sort of coming together makes a lot of sense, especially since many of the evolutionary astrologers I've met are like psychologists, are trained in psychology, but they're still using it for this sort of alternate sort of spiritualistic sort of purpose. I'm not sure how Indian astrology ties into that, just because even though it's interesting how with a tradition where you do have, you know, literally the origins of some of those concepts like karma and reincarnation, at least as terms, you know, Indian astrology is much more concrete and is much more event-oriented. It's much more about this lifetime. And even if some of the placements are the result of past actions and past karmas, it's interesting how the Indian astrologers tend to be much more focused on the concrete realities of what will take place in this lifetime. And in that way, it sort of sets itself apart. It pushes it more. Indian astrology comes off more like traditional Western astrology to me than it does look like the sort of what we conceptualize as karmic, you know, past life astrology of the evolutionary astrologers or what have you.
Yeah, I would agree. But I think that, so if we're looking at different astrological traditions, and they're able to say, this is so, right? You know, you are broke, you are rich, you are happy, you know, you are strong in this way. We're able to, you know, every astrology makes a statement or a series of statements about a person's life, either on either internally or externally. And every tradition has a different explanatory mechanism, you know, because people ask, well, why, right? And if we look at Vedic astrology, the why is karmic, primarily karmic, right? Mm-hmm. And so, and the evolutionary astrology also has the same want, right? Yes, it's karmic. What I see Vedic astrologers doing is saying, well, that your life on the outside is shaped this way because of your karma. Whereas the evolutionary astrologers seem to be focused on the internal landscape and saying that your internal landscape is this way because of your karma, right? And then both have different methods of remediation. You know, the Vedic methods of remediation there are a lot of them, right? There's mantra, there's basically a talismanic tradition, there's ritual, whereas the method of remediation in evolutionary astrology seems to be primarily therapeutic. And so I guess where I see them connecting is in both using a karmic causation model.
Sure. And that actually makes sense and leads us to probably one of the future trends, which is, on the one hand, you have, you know, late 20th century astrology tended to be more psychologically focused and tended to conceptualize most things in a person's birth chart in terms of a person's psyche or character. And mm-hmm. one of the trends that we've seen recently with the revival of Indian astrology and traditional astrology is a more outward-oriented, event-oriented type of astrology. So perhaps that's one of the threads or themes that we will probably see played out over the course of the next one or two or three decades is somebody or people attempting to synthesize these two different approaches. Do you have these two different extremes where you either are focused on the internal realities of the person's psyche and character versus the external realities of their circumstances and the cards that they were literally dealt in their life and the attempt to reconcile those two approaches?
Yeah, I think that's okay, so if I can just talk a little bit about that. I learned a pretty thoroughly modern astrology. I'm one of those self-taught people, and I was lucky enough to find used copies of Noel Till's entire series of Haylearn astrology books. I don't remember what they're called. There are like 8 or 9 of them,
right?
And they have all of them at the used bookstore for like $1.25 each.
Wow.
Right?
Nice.
Yeah, it was good find. And so, I don't know, you know, after 5 years of reading those and working with those, and as a student of psychology at the time, this was back when I was in college, I got pretty good at understanding what was inside a person, looking through their chart. And with myself, I was, one of the greatest early benefits I got from astrology was a language of self-understanding. But, you know, I remember when I first got really oriented to traditional techniques, which for me, I didn't, you know, I came through the Hellenistic door rather than the medieval or Renaissance door. And I was like, oh my God, you can actually predict things, like events.
Right.
You know, because it was sort of like, you know, there's sort of a lot of the books, I guess in the 80s and 90s, maybe the 70s, had made this case for astrology that was like, hey, no, you can't predict the future, but you can do all this other wonderful stuff.
Right.
And I'd sort of accepted that. And I was like, hey, this is good enough. This is a really useful tool.
Yeah, that's like the first thing you learn when you get into astrology nowadays is astrology is not concretely predictive and you cannot predict events. You can only predict psychological states and things like that.
Right. And I'd accepted that and I was cool with that. But I had some experiences doing some readings for people and seeing some things play out really literally. And then, you know, many years later, I encountered the Project Hindsight material, and I was like, no, you can totally predict stuff. And, you know, given 6 months to play with it, I was totally predicting stuff. And so that, And we're talking about kind of a technical reorientation when you incorporate material from another part of the tradition. And that's one thing, but there's also sort of a philosophical reorientation when you go from just looking at internal states to events. You know, it was sort of like, oh my God, you can predict things. It sort of frames the ratio of fate and free will, or, you know, the sort of matrix of choices and necessity that we're inside of in a whole new way.
Sure.
And, you know, people are as beholden to their paradigms as they are to their techniques. And I think it's very difficult to separate the two in astrology, because if you can predict events, well, that has really huge philosophical ramifications, right?
And ethical ramifications.
Ethical ramifications as well, right? So there's just a lot packed into, what seems like just do this with the chart instead of just use this different house system. You know, there's a lot riding on what seems like a small technical shift.
Right. Yeah. And so I guess we shouldn't then beat around the bush, because we have this like list of topics to focus on, and we were going to talk about all these different things. But in reality, I think you and I would, and many of the people that we know, would both agree that the synthesis of modern and traditional astrology, of late 20th century astrology, which is what we're defining as modern, and traditional astrology, which we're defining as the type of astrology practiced from the first century BC to the 17th century CE, that the synthesis of those two approaches and all of the technical and philosophical and ethical issues that come up during the process of doing that, that from our perspective, at least, that's one of the great issues or great things that are going to be worked out over the course of the next few decades. And that presumably eventually we'll see a synthesis of, but it's going to be interesting seeing the exact details of how some astrologers choose to deal with some of the specific issues that come up during the process of that.
Yeah, I think it's huge. I mean, it's certainly been a big theme in my own practice for at least the last half decade or so. I guess here are my thoughts on that, my working notes on that, as of right now. And it's simply that life is composed of events, and there's an external event and there's also an internal state. You can't really, I disagree with attempts to simplify life to merely think events which happen to us, or merely to internal states. There's an interplay between who we are and what's happening in our life. I don't like the idea that what's happening to us externally is totally a result of our own mind, that if we were just, more positive thinkers, nothing bad would happen. I think that's very limited. I think there's a degree of that in place, certainly. But then the implication of that belief is that every single thing that happens to you is your fault, and if you weren't such a negative Nelly, it would be better.
Sure.
And, it becomes absurd at a certain point. And then I think the very hard determinist model also breaks down to absurdity. We certainly have the experience of choice, and whether, I guess here's from a pragmatic point of view, we have the experience of meaningful choice. We totally have seen ourselves, we've experienced making a meaningful choice and seeing the results. And then we've also experienced situations in which we have no say whatsoever. One good example, because it happens to almost everyone, is a person's parents dying, right? There's no positive thinking that's going to keep that at bay, right? That's a huge experience, and there's no stopping it, right?
Sure.
And so just taking these very basic experiences, I think an important place to begin the synthesis is just to agree that there are things we're in control of and there are things we aren't in control of, and to just abandon these extreme positions, which some people seem to hold.
Sure. Yeah, that's definitely an issue because it's sort of an off, not an offset, but it's a side effect of one of the modern viewpoints. I don't know where it came from. I guess it came from the Jungian school, although it must have existed elsewhere because it's really been picked up and advocated very hard by the people that are into the secret and the law of attraction and stuff like that. That's not like, it's not psychology. It's some like side new age thing. And that belief that, you know, you completely create your own reality by the things that you think about or what you focus your attention towards. But it's interesting that that's so popular now with The Secret and some of those things in the past decade. But even if you look back in the 1970s and you read like Robert Hand's Planets and Transits, you'll see him sometimes saying, you know, if you have this transit and if you do not internalize it psychologically, if you don't internalize it yourself somehow and play it out, then it will manifest in your life as an external event. And I think that's what you're referring to. And that is kind of dangerous because it often, even for things that are completely outside of the person's control and are not their fault at all, if they suffer trauma or extreme hardship or tragedy or what have you, and to sort of place that in the person's lap and say that it's their fault for not, you know, internalizing some sort of transit or psychological impulse, that's certainly one of the shadow sides that's come out of psychological astrology in the past, I think, decade or two, one of the downsides. But on the plus sides, I think, obviously, there's a lot of positive things that we have to say about psychological astrology, and that's definitely going to be one of the mainstream approaches and schools that we'll see continuing to develop in the future. But it will be interesting seeing how it interfaces with how psychological astrology in those schools interface with some of the more traditional and more deterministic and more, I guess, event-oriented schools.
One note about let's just say the set of astrological approaches that seek to predict events. I don't think I've read a single traditional text that claims that every single thing in a person's life can be predicted. And I think it's extremely important to note that because some things can be predicted, it doesn't mean that everything can be predicted. Does that make sense?
Well, yeah. I mean, there's a distinction between, there's two questions. There's A, is everything predetermined, yes or no? And then B, if everything is predetermined, can it be predicted, yes or no?
Right.
So there's a scenario where everything is predetermined, but you still can't predict everything with astrology.
Sure. Well, and I guess my question is a little to the sideways from that, which is that I think people make the assumption that, oh my God, if you can predict one thing, like if, you know, we're running like a releasing from spirit procedure on someone's chart, and we can figure out the 2 years where their career really hits its stride and they gain recognition for what they do, does that mean that everything is predictable? Right? You know, just because one thing is predictable doesn't mean another thing is predictable. There's, I encountered sort of some maxims in a Vedic text I was reading sometime back. I can't recall the name. It was basically a rule of thumb. It was sort of like, if there's one strong indicator for something, let's say wealth, then it's possible, right? Two strong indicators, it's likely. They're going to have to try really hard to mess that up. And then three strong indicators, no, that's just the way it's going to be.
Right, the rule of three?
Yeah, and I, you know, what that suggests to me and sort of how I approach charts is that there is a spectrum of control and and the degree to which something is determined. You know, because some things, good luck stopping them, and then there are other things, you know, it sure seems like we have a lot of control over certain parts of our lives. I mean, these are, and I don't know, part of the reason I'm so determined to take sort of a pragmatic, boots on the ground sort of look at this is because we can't know ultimately, right? You know, there's no access to any method of surety. Like, sure, everything could be totally determined, but that it's impossible to make an airtight case for that. And the same for the extreme position, that everything is a choice, right? And so I guess from where I see it, and from the human perspective, it looks like there's plenty of both going on in human life, and insofar as astrology is a tool that looks at human life, it should allow for both categories. And I think that there are, between the modern approach and more traditional approaches, we have the technology, to look at things, to look at situations from both angles, and hopefully to be able to tell what kind of situation we're looking at.
Sure.
Whether it's going to be pushed along regardless, or whether it's really up to them.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, I think I don't want to go too far afield with this, just because I'm sure we could do an entire show about this issue of just determinism in astrology, and I would very much like to, or could easily adopt the counter position and make the hypothetical argument that, astrology implies that things are more predetermined than we might like, or than we might think initially, even than most astrologers might think. But I don't necessarily want to completely refocus the show on that.
I think it's sufficient to say that this hornet's nest is part of what astrology has to deal with in the decades going forward. Both collectively as well as individually, right? This is what we started talking about modern and traditional, and this came up. And I think that this isn't the only conversation where modern and traditional will come back to this issue.
Yeah, definitely, because it gets to the heart of what is the purpose of astrology and what are you doing it for? Because depending on what philosophical model or conceptual model you adopt, you're going to have a different answer to that question. If you think everything is predetermined and that astrology can tell you something about the future, you're going to have a certain specific purpose for wanting to know the future, versus if you don't think everything is predetermined, if you think there's some things left open to free will, then that's going to leave you with a completely different reason for wanting to know things about the future. That brings us back to one of our points, which is one of the trends that was happening for a while, especially in the 70s and 80s, is astrologers, because astrology had become so much focused on psychology, there were a lot of astrologers who were contextualizing astrology as a purely consulting setting, and that astrology was purely for psychological analysis, and that a lot of people were trying to get degrees in depth psychology in order to be more respectable and be able to fully have people as clients or patients or what have you, to be able to treat them psychologically and use astrology as an additional tool for that. However, it seems like things have broadened. It seems like there's a lot more, or many different applications of astrology, or many different people are using astrology in different ways or different contexts. And that might be a fruitful area for discussion in terms of what the future looks like in what the different roles are for astrologers in the coming decades.
Certainly. What does an astrologer do? Right.
Right.
So as you were saying, there's, from what I understand, in the 80s and 90s, many astrologers were therapists or doing something very close to therapy.
Right.
And I would juxtapose that with the older model. This is how I frame what I do personally, as a consultant, right? And that I am, the astrologer can look at certain factors and answer certain questions about what's going on, so that the client can make informed and strategic decisions. Right, this is sort of the older role of the astrologer as the advisor to the monarch, right, or to the nobility, where they've got what they want to do, and then they consult the astrologer to see what might be the best time to do that. What factors that only the astrologer with access to the technology we have is going to be able to ferret out that the person might not be able to see, right?
Sure.
And there is a psychological side to that. You can say, I don't think it's beyond the the limits of traditional astrology to look at a client's chart and say, you're going, you will be of ill health and lacking vitality for these 2 months, right? And so that's a factor. If you're planning something, if you're planning your, your big book launch tour, you might not want to plan it while you're having like a terrible health transit, if that could be avoided, or the Time Lords are playing out that way.
Sure.
So again, that does, there is some, let's say, personal information there. But that's it's a different role than the therapist who's going to basically, who's, I guess, more of a healer, in essence, who's going to sit down with someone and help fix problems or heal wounds or walk through that healing process with someone.
Yeah, and to do it regularly also, that's another potential difference is that model almost sets it up. If you're doing it within the context of therapy, it's really more of like a repeat thing. It's like a process that you go through over a number of years versus, somebody just reading your chart one time and telling you some things about your life. And then that's really the end of it. You don't need to go back to them again necessarily repeatedly for some process-oriented approach.
Right, right. Or, again, from sort of an advisor model, like checking in every 3 to 6 months to get the lowdown on the quarter ahead. Right. So in order to plan and make decisions and set realistic expectations,
sure.
That's very different from working out and working through old traumas with someone, where if you're only doing it every 6 months, you're probably not making much progress. Right.
Right.
This demands a consistency.
And then we also have the use of other branches that sort of dovetails with what you're saying about, people checking in every few months, because then you have things like the revival of horary astrology. So you have some astrologers now who primarily or solely take horary questions and cast the chart for the moment that they receive the question in order to answer just a single specific outcome. And that's pretty non-therapeutic for the most part. That's pretty event-oriented. And then also you have people who are doing electional astrology, which seems like it's I want to say it's become more popular lately, because I don't feel like there was a ton of books about electional astrology for most of the 20th century. And now, especially with the revival of traditional astrology, where electional astrology was used a lot more, it seems like it's becoming a little bit more popular. I don't know if that's true, but it's just my...
I think so. I certainly do elections, and so do you. And I know a lot of astrologers who they may not advertise that they do elections, but they sure look at where everything is when they're planning something.
Right. Like the void of course moon and Mercury retrograde. I mean, there's like some popular stuff like that, that at the very least is taken into account.
I think if there is a comeback or a rise in popularity in electional astrology, I think it is intimately related to, our re-encounter with traditional texts, not simply because there's electional material in there, but you really have to be grounded in traditional technique in order to make electional work.
Right.
I think this is actually a huge difference between a lot of modern astrology and a lot of traditional astrology. In traditional astrology, we're very concerned with judging the quality and efficacy of a given planet, right? Can it do its job? Will it, can it do its job? Is it debilitated? Does it do its job with, terrible side effects? Is it bona fide? We're very interested in sort of a vertical ranking of how good or bad that planet will play out, or how favorable or unfavorable, to use your terms.
Right, making distinctions like strong or weak, good or bad.
Right, whereas when you're in a therapeutic environment, it's really important for therapeutic language to be as judgment-free as possible.
Right.
That may be a fantasy if you look at, a lot of the way mental health has been handled, and it's a lot of, it all starts with a sane-insane category, dichotomy. But still, the therapeutic approach is to say, okay, so this is what you're feeling. We don't need to judge that, but we just need to get to it. And see it clearly.
Sure.
And so that, and you see the use of astrology, or the way that the planets and their positions and conditions are interpreted is very different in a therapeutic setting with good purpose than it is in a traditional setting or for an electional setting. Right.
Yeah. And especially, I guess, one distinction that was really within the context of psychological astrology in the 70s and 80s was really rejected was the concept of benefic and malefic planets being inappropriate in a consulting setting or in terms of judging people's charts or people's lives like that. But then also they questioned whether it was the efficacy of that distinction technically, whereas something like that is absolutely crucial for electional astrology because you can't you can't figure out what an auspicious date in the future looks like unless you know what an inauspicious or a bad looking date, for lack of a better term, would look like in the future hypothetically. And that very much relies on distinctions like benefic and malefic.
Yeah, no, the astrologer is being hired in that case to make a judgment and to rank one date above another.
Right. Rather than just saying, and that's the main issue that you would run into if you're a modern psychological astrologer trying to do electional astrology is you've already adopted an approach that it's all good, that it's all the same, and that everything has its pluses and minuses, but it's all essentially on the same level at some point.
Value neutral language.
Sure. Okay, so that's one thing that will be, we'll sort of move this discussion along. That's one thing that'll be re-examined is some of those distinctions and things like that and how to reconcile some of those sort of approaches or extremes between those two viewpoints in terms of making those distinctions or not making those distinctions or when to apply them and when not to apply them or whether they're valuable, whether there's something to them or whether they're useless. A lot of those discussions will have to take place. So we're talking a lot about sort of the revival of traditional astrology and some of those concepts. And we're talking about psychological astrology as sort of a new innovation in the modern period, but there were also some other innovations and there's some continuing innovations in the modern period. One of them is, early in the century, we had the innovation of Uranian astrology and cosmobiology, which were almost like completely different schools of astrology that sort of sprang up out of nowhere and were using techniques that were completely unique or independent. Then later in the century, we have the innovation of things like the continuing discovery of the asteroids and more recently of minor planets or planetoid bodies sort of floating out there in the solar system. And the solar system itself keeps expanding and growing. And many astrologers seem to keep right away integrating some of these new bodies into their charts, like the asteroids or like some of these minor planets like Sedna or Eris or what have you. So that's something that we're going to have to figure out what to do with as well.
Yeah, absolutely. That's in many ways, that's one meaningful sort of beginning. There's been a lot of discussion about what is quote unquote traditional astrology, right? When does it end? When does it start? And if we're talking about the difference between modern and traditional, you know, one place to position that boundary is the discovery of Uranus or George, right?
Right.
And because it hugely problematized Uranus, the discovery of Uranus and the Copernican revolution, right? The recentering of our understanding of the cosmos, our understanding of our world on the sun rather than on the earth. Right. Mm-hmm. And since then, as you said, there's been a continuing slow torrent of challenges and additions to the traditional model. And I think that we've been talking, I think, a fair amount about what challenges modern astrology faces, right? The psychological astrology needs to come to terms with. But I think that the traditional community needs to develop as a whole some more sophisticated responses to what about Uranus, what about Neptune?
Yeah, definitely.
And so, you know, again, I think this is, as you framed at the beginning, this is, ideally, it will be shaped like a dialogue.
I don't know. Ideally.
I don't know if everyone will conform to that standard, but I think it's at least dialectic, right? There's definitely there are definitely issues on both sides of that.
Yeah, I mean, one of those big issues is the rulership scheme, because that's been one of the big technical changes in the transition from traditional to modern astrology, and it's one of the big things that astrologers are starting to really fight about now with some of these changes that are going on, is what's the rationale for assigning planets to signs through the rulership scheme, and you know, should new planetary bodies be included in that scheme, or should some asteroids be included in that scheme, or should the original rulership scheme be maintained, and if so, why? And that's an area where both, contrary to what some traditional astrologers think, both modern and traditional astrologers have some weaknesses in the arguments that they've been using. I mean, modern astrologers will say right away, because their entire conceptualization of planetary, of sign rulership, is that planets have an affinity through similar meanings with certain signs, and that's what the rulerships are based on. But that's kind of flawed, because over the past century, they've completely swapped many of the significations between certain... They've taken some significations from certain planets and applied those to certain signs, and they've taken some significations from certain signs and applied them to certain planets. So at this point, they would think that, because that's how the system's been completely rebuilt over the course of the past century, but that wasn't necessarily always the case.
And as I think you've made clear in some of your work, that's not the original rationale. You know, what's glorious about the present is that we have unprecedented access to texts which seem to present much of the original rationale, the Thema Mundi being primary among them.
Yeah, and that seems to have been the core rationale initially for sign rulership, but then that leads to this other issue where traditional astrologers try to make this counter-argument that sign rulership has nothing to do with affinity between planet and sign, and there is no connection. And that's actually kind of a flawed argument as well. Or it's not like a fully consistent one, because even if you just base rulership on the Thema Mundi, and the premise of the Thema Mundi is that you start from the two signs that coincide with the summer solstice in the northern hemisphere, the hottest and brightest part of the year, and you assign the two luminaries, or the two lights, to those signs, to Cancer and Leo, and then the rest of the signs get assigned sort of flanking out in zodiacal order, from Mercury to Venus to Mars to Jupiter to Saturn. But then there's a problem there, because even if you use that traditionally, the modern assignments of Neptune, of Uranus to Aquarius, and then Neptune to Pisces would actually follow that rationale quite nicely. So even traditional astrologers have to be careful about that argument, because it's still not entirely a fully consistent argument that could be used against them if they try and completely have recourse to that.
Yeah, absolutely. So I just want to share a brief anecdote. I was just looking at this astrological pamphlet that was published in 1903, called Tattered and Worn Away, and I was just, you know, looking through it, and not only is rulership in there, but all of the lesser dignities which people associate with, you know, way old astrology, like medieval stuff, was in there as well. The triplicity rulers were present,
right.
Firms, the decans. It was, you know, and I encountered that material, as I mentioned, through the Hellenistic doorway, right? So I have it associated with this, you know, much older period. And of course it's present, in the medieval and Renaissance material, but, you don't hear a lot about, you know, I suppose the narrative you hear about modern astrology is that they abandoned that, you know, sometime in the 17th century, 18th century. Whereas you have like, and this is, and this text is sort of the only astrology book you'll ever need of its day. It's written in a very approachable tone. And that's not consistent with, I think, the way that people describe modern astrology. I think when people say modern, I think we've both been guilty of this, even in this conversation. What they're actually referring to is post-60s astrology.
Right. Yeah, I mean, the traditional astrologer, or some parts of traditional astrology, like circa everything prior to the 17th century, made it much further into the 20th century than we would think. And that's actually part of what most of the books that people are familiar with today, like Alan Oaken's Complete Astrology or Noel Till's work or some of Rob Hand's work or Liz Green's work, they're responding to, and when they're rejecting some concepts like benefic and malefic, they're rejecting stuff that was still being used when they all started entering the field in the 60s. So there's much more continuity. I think that's what you're alluding to.
Yeah. And just that, again, to head back to one of my first statements, to understand where things are headed in the future or what future we can create, I think it's very important to have an accurate idea of what happened in the past. And imagining that people chucked rulership sometime in the 19th century is not true and therefore not useful. Right. I think that, ironically, part of the movement towards greater scholarship, especially in regard to the history of the tradition, is uncovering that even the modern period is very different. You know, only a couple generations back is different than the way that it's often presented.
Sure. Yeah. And I mean, just things can change. One of the take-home lessons for that, and I think for us in looking at the future, is that things can change very rapidly, much quicker than you would think, over the course of a decade or maybe a decade and a half, maybe 2 decades. That's really how long it took for what we conceptualize as modern astrology essentially to take over in the late 20th century, probably around the 60s and 70s and 80s. And you can see evidence of that, for example, in what Kelly and I discussed a couple of episodes back, which is the striking number of people who suddenly have adopted whole sign houses just in the past five years, basically, maybe 10 years tops. Suddenly, that's one of the major competing forms of house division, and it's happened almost overnight, especially considering that it's a form of house division that was previously not known about in contemporary astrology up until very recently, and now all of a sudden everybody's using it, and it's not sort of, it hasn't displaced Placidus yet, but it's certainly become a runner-up, which is quite surprising, I think.
Yeah, and I think what's even more remarkable about that, or more interesting about that, is that the whole sign houses operate under a wholly different set of assumptions. Right, it's not another quadrant style house system. It's not another way to divide the space between the angles. Right, the ascendant marks the first house, and the entirety of that sign is the first. And so it's actually, you know, it's a radical departure from, you know, the list of 15 other house systems that people use.
Yeah, so that's a great example of something where that just comes out of nowhere. I mean, that was an old thing that was rediscovered that's completely changing the landscape of how many astrologers look at astrology and conceptualize charts. But it's almost happened overnight within the broader, you know, timeline of things. Like a decade is not a very long period of time, or 5 years is not a very long period of time for hundreds of astrologers to suddenly switch how they're looking at charts. And that might, I mean, we can't anticipate changes like that. There could be things that come up in the next decade or 2 decades or 3 decades that are like that, where suddenly there's some new technique or some old technique that's recovered that people start using and that people think makes sense, and everyone just starts adopting it very quickly. There's something about that unfortunately, while we're having this discussion, like, we won't fully be able to anticipate because of this factor where you can't really know all of the things that could come up or be recovered or conversely be discovered or invented. So, so let's transition. One of the things that you're involved with, I think you attended recently, and this is less of a technical thing and more of a social thing, but you attended the first queer astrology conference in San Francisco that took place in July of last month, July of 2013, right?
Mm-hmm.
How did that go, or what was the focus of that conference? Did you feel like, what was the focus? Was it, were there things that were new that you saw there? Was it about reorienting astrology towards a certain viewpoint? Was it about making room for it? Was it about acknowledging techniques or interpretive principles that were not previously acknowledged? Or what was the purpose of that conference?
Well, to paraphrase the organizer, Ian Weisler, I think part of it was to bring a lot of questions to astrology from a variety of viewpoints and to see what came out of that. So let me give you some examples of what I thought were some of the really interesting questions that came up. You know, it got pointed out that the etymological root of the word queer is query, right? To question.
Okay. Right?
And so I believe the first presentation pointed out what I thought were some really great things. You said the astrologer's name was, it was Yolo. I don't remember his last name. But what he pointed out is that a lot of the way that astrologers write is to heterosexual people who want to get married.
Sure.
Right?
Sure.
That's built into a number of counseling astrologers' approach, and it's certainly built into the mass market astrology.
Sure.
And with the horoscopes and the books, like some of the Linda Goodman books that have sort of the horoscope audience in mind. And I think simply drawing attention to that and saying, hey, you know what? There are a lot of people who don't want to do that. Not all the heterosexual people want to get married. Also, not all the boys are interested in girls, and not all the girls are interested in boys. And just, you know, and part of what was really interesting, and I think educational for me, was hearing. So I'm a straight guy, and so there were some things I hadn't thought as hard about. And so listening to people who found that pretty, you know, who found those who were more sensitized to those assumptions and were in some ways alienated by it. It was just interesting to sort of rediscover some of the texts and unpack some of the assumptions that were there that if you asked me, I would have said, sure, that's there. But I hadn't thought as hard about it because of, you know, my relationship to the material. I do think one thing, so I'm not quote unquote gay, but there are a lot of people who are heterosexual who nonetheless maybe aren't oriented towards marriage. You know, there's a lot of traditional technique where it's like, or even there's a lot of traditional technique and there's also a lot of, typical questions where people are like, when am I going to get married? Right?
Sure.
And so, just questioning that assumption that, you know, to lead a happy and successful life, that should be one feature of it. You know, the Queer Astrology Conference, I think, helped bring my attention to the fact that a lot of astrologers and a lot of astrology are reinforcing these very culturally bounded assumptions about what is, you know, how should you be living, right? And in many ways, I think it brings up a question that it brings up a viewpoint that I like to think is sort of inherent to astrology, which is that everybody has a different life, you know, and there are different forms of happiness and satisfaction, and that even if you're doing a more traditional form of consulting, pushing someone towards a social norm isn't necessarily, that may or may not be appropriate for them, is not terribly helpful, right? So I think that was certainly, there was a lot that went on that weekend, but I think asking these questions about the assumptions that are built into a lot of text was really useful.
Sure, yeah, definitely, and that's certainly something I would expect to see explored more in the coming decades, is how astrologers deal with things like gender roles and, you know, different types of relationships, of sexual relationships or romantic relationships or what have you. So I'm sure that that's a huge area that's going to be redefined and is going to be perhaps look somewhat different. I don't want to say quite different, because there might be some it's interesting because in some of the traditional texts, there might be more of an access point for this because of, at least in some instances, how they were more capable of dealing with certain gender roles or certain things pertaining to sexual identity. Although obviously in some ways they were not necessarily as enlightened or whatever you want to call it.
One of the examples that got brought up was how in traditional texts, it will say, you know, as an indicator for a man being homosexual, it'll be like, and, you know, and he will be a sinner and a sodomite, right? Or, you know, it uses traditional texts that, you know, convey the cultural norms at the time and place they were written. And so maybe that's a useful technique, but that language is not very helpful. And if that's you, thick skin or not, that's not exactly, those aren't pretty words.
Right. And that's one of the things that's funny about reading, for example, something from the Roman tradition is some of those delineations are in there, but you get weird cultural things like it's positive, like they'll say stuff like that, but it's only cast negatively if you're the passive partner in a homosexual relationship. If you're the active, you know, partner that's essentially on top or what have you, that's fine. Culturally speaking, in a Roman context, but the negative delineation is if you're the passive partner.
Right.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I think that's part of where my head went. It was sort of like, I wonder if these are actually useful techniques, but we need to kind of strip away some of the culturally based value judgment.
Yeah, I think there is, because what's funny is in some of that stuff, like it will talk about homosexuality and different things, but oftentimes in the Hellenistic texts, they'll make distinctions about who is more, they'll contextualize it as like active or masculine versus being passive or feminine through looking at things like if Venus is a morning star as being more masculinized or more, let's say, active versus Venus being an evening star and being feminized or being more passive. And I think some of those delineation tools can be applied usefully if they're just sort of redefined in some of the language to sort of gender neutral delineation techniques in the modern period. I think it just needs to be, I think, looked at with fresh eyes.
Yeah, and value neutral as well. Like,
right.
Like, congratulations, you're a straight guy. You know, like, no. It's not better to be a straight guy than any of the other variations we're talking about.
Sure.
Right?
Sure.
And anyway, there's a lot of questioning going on. There were a number of presentations. I really don't think I have time to go over everything.
Yeah.
I would like to say that Christopher Renstrom gave just a tremendous talk. I was really blown away. It was titled "The Saturn Return of AIDS,"
mm-hmm.
I guess he began with what I think is a really interesting, just astrological project, is can you find a chart for AIDS, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so the chart that he worked from, which was the result of some pretty serious research, was the meeting where I believe it was the National Institute of Health named this virus. That they'd been seeing on and off for a few years and didn't know exactly what to make of it. But it was the meeting where they gave it a name, right?
Okay.
Which is an interesting sense. It's interesting. I don't know. I thought that's an interesting moment to cast a chart for. And then he basically talked about the history of AIDS as bisected by the Saturn cycle, which was really interesting and lined up perfectly with some of the big turning points, but he also wove that in with a personal narrative about that time and about living through that. That was just extraordinary. It was really he integrated. We're talking about where astrology is at right now. He integrated explicitly traditional techniques. He looked at house joys, for example, as well as what I thought was a very nuanced version of the mythological approach. That's something we might also talk about in terms of recent modern astrology versus traditional, is the interpretation of planets in a mythological context. Instead of saying, "Oh, Apollo, you know, the sun is Apollo, and he's like this," He really dug through the myths that the Hellenistic practitioners of astrology would have believed, would have known. And it was really, it was a masterful talk. And not a few people cried. It was great. I just feel like I need to, my apologies to everybody else who was there and did fine work, but Christopher really did something special.
Yeah, I've heard that from a few different people before, so I hope, I don't know, either that talk is available as a recording at some point, or he does it elsewhere, or publishes that as a paper or something, so we'll be able to learn more about it. That you brought up myth as an interpretive principle, and that's a really important one because that's become such a core tool. It's a technical tool that's being used in order to understand not just the planets and their significations in astrology, but also the asteroids and some of the newly discovered planetary bodies. Like, that's become, in the late 20th and early 21st century, the first thing that astrologers look to when they're trying to figure out what a new astronomical body means, is they'll look at the mythology associated with the name of that planetary body. And that's interesting because that really, you don't see that prior to, that's one of those techniques that was innovated in the 1960s and 70s, and that's become so commonplace that people don't realize that it wasn't really used that much like that prior to the late 20th century.
Yeah, I think it's an interesting and very thorny thing to bring under the lens of criticism, because you definitely don't see it in, like, oh, I don't know, let's just say, like, Benatti.
Right,
13th century. But, and it's not that you see it explicitly in Hellenistic texts, but if you live in a time period where everybody who you've ever known is familiar with Greek myths, right? You know, the entire almost the entire Mediterranean is Hellenized at that point. That may not be, the Greek gods and goddesses may not be. People's, it may not be the dominant form of religious praxis in every area, but everybody's heard of it, right? Those simply saying, you know, Zeus, Jupiter is doing this, is going to bring up a huge string of associations, right? And a lot of that doesn't have to be written when you're writing in that context.
Sure.
And then there are some, in my work on the Decans, if you look at the Hellenistic interpretations of the Decans, they're almost all, like, all the meanings are encapsulated by mythical figures. They're like, oh, this goddess, this Decan's powers are represented by this demigod, or this Decan's powers are represented by Leto, who is the mother of Apollo and Artemis. Right, and so there is some. I mean, the Decans are their own weird, funky strand of astrology.
Right.
But there is Hellenistic era astrological material that does use these often minor mythological figures to communicate a complex of meanings.
Sure. I guess it's just the question or the debate that's going to start taking place is how much. Like, is that the first thing that you think of when you start interpreting a planetary body or a astronomical body in a chart? And also, to what extent or what percentage of your delineation should revolve around myth? Because I think one of the critiques is that prior to the very recently, like the past 30 or 40 years, that wasn't the first thing that astrologers had recourse to when they were trying to figure out what a new planet meant. Like, they instead started actually placing it in charts and trying to see what it correlated with in reality through transits or through just natal placement. So we get these funny stories like the one about, I can't remember his name, John Varley from like the 18th, 19th century, who was a painter but also an astrologer. And there's that great story about how he'd been following Uranus for some time, and he kept seeing it show up in certain contexts. So he thought it meant like an unexpected disruption or an unexpected violent event. And he saw that it was going to be hitting his chart in a particular way on a particular day. So he sort of like shut himself up inside his house and wouldn't go outside. And then at the sort of specific hour at which Uranus was hitting his chart exactly, his house catches on fire and it burns to the ground, and he runs outside and starts scribbling in his notebook right away in order to record the event. So it's like we have funny stories about that, about astrologers doing empirical work in order to understand what the planets mean, and that's their first and that's their primary access point for coming up with the significations of new planets. But that's completely changed. Like nowadays, the first and the primary access point for new planetary bodies like Sedna or Eris is what is the mythology associated with the name? And there was a lot of astrologers that couldn't do anything with it, that didn't do anything with it until the planetary body was named, because they were so at a loss for how to even approach figuring that out otherwise, or they just that approach has become so ingrained in the use of the mythology of the name that it's like the primary thing at that point. And I think that's where there might be some room for criticism, and there will be some debate in coming decades about the appropriateness of that.
So I think it's useful to recognize that there's often a level of resonance between a name and what the planet does astrologically. But to take one name, let's take Neptune, right, and say that all of the stories that the Greeks associated with this god are totally relevant to what Neptune in a chart does, I don't think anyone would agree that that's a great way to deal with the planet, with the astrological Neptune. Does Neptune have to do with water? Yeah, it seems to. But the planet Neptune also seems to have a lot to do physically with gases. We also, sort of standard things that it's associated with are drugged states, or states with where consciousness is altered. Dreams are very commonly associated with Neptune. These have very little to do with mythological Neptune. Like, we've got the water thing, right?
Sure. But
I don't think many, even sort of strict mythologic or, you know, astrologers who are really mining the myth, I don't think many of them are going to argue that the mythological Neptune, who's a big dude who bulls are sacred to, is really the best window into the astrological Neptune. I think it's important to note there is a resonance, right? It's like if you start with the ocean and what that represents, and also physically water, I think you get to some places that are very relevant for the astrological Neptune. But there are also a lot of dead ends. Also, this is a very important distinction to make. There are different cultures have different myths that they associate with different planets. The Vedic stories about Mars are not the same as the Greek stories about Aries, right? They're not the same. And the Venus, Aphrodite to the Greeks, is Shukra to Vedic astrologers. Did not only different stories, but different gender.
Right.
And so it's like if we do want to take this mythological approach, we have to be aware that there isn't just one culture's set of stories that's going to do the whole thing, you know?
Yeah, that's a good point, because like there are a whole other mythological set of deities associated with the planets, for example, in Indian astrology, and Indian astrologers sometimes do have recourse to those stories to explain what the planets mean, but in many instances they're like completely different and have no bearing on the Western Greek or Roman myths. So,
I'm sorry, one thing I just should bring up, I feel like we'd be wrong not to mention the Babylonians and their association between planets and gods. I think that's the earliest really clear, tight association we have between stories and planets.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, and the Greeks explicitly, when they were naming and associating some of their gods in the Greek pantheon with certain planets, which had a specific date. It's like prior to the, I think it's like the 4th or 5th century BCE, you don't see those associations, but then all of a sudden they show up. But the Greeks explicitly matched the gods in their pantheon with the gods in the Mesopotamian or Babylonian pantheon, And that's why some of those, you know, that's why Zeus is associated with Jupiter, and that's why Aphrodite is associated with Venus, because they tried to make the pick the god that matched in their pantheon the same god in the Mesopotamian pantheon.
Right. Like, well, Marduk, Zeus, close enough, right?
Right. Or I like Mars's name in it's like Akkadian or in the Mesopotamian tradition was Nurgle.
Yeah.
Which does not sound, it's not as, doesn't not strike fear into the hearts of men when you hear the name Nurgle.
Nurgle is far, far fiercer than the Greek Ares, though. What's interesting is he had rulership over, plague-bearing winds, pestilent winds that would bring death to many.
Okay.
And he did have an association with intemperate heat as well, which is not so much there with the Greek Aries, but is totally there in our understanding, our traditional understanding of Mars.
Sure.
Intemperate heat is his thing.
Sure. Anyway. So speaking of intemperate winds, that is one other point that could potentially be important for the future and that might be worth discussing, which is the issue of the possibility of new scientific discoveries, since our understanding, scientific understanding of the universe is always expanding. Could there be additional scientific discoveries that have implications for astrology? One thing that came out very recently, it was a story in the news in the past week or two, was that some Swiss researchers found evidence that the lunar cycle may have an effect on sleep patterns, because they found that the total number or total time of sleep that a person has is lowest at the full moon. And that there was some statistically significant like percentage of people that this correlated with, so that it was actually seemed to be an actual thing. And a lot of astrologers were taking this and sort of trumpeting this as proof of astrology. How do you feel about that?
Well, I think that astrology makes a lot of assumptions that go pretty far beyond that. So I think it's hyperbole to say it validates astrology as a whole. I think it's interesting. I'm not surprised. I don't think many astrologers or even many people would be surprised by the findings of that. It's sort of, in some ways, it was sort of like when the latest, diet study comes out. And they're like, if you eat a bunch of fat, it makes you gain weight. You know, it's sort of like, really?
Right.
Thanks, science.
Right.
It's interesting. I think it gets people thinking about the relationship between life on Earth and the various other bodies in our solar system, which just sticking to a strictly materialist scientific perspective is really fascinating. You know, the entire... all of life on Earth has grown up under the pull of the moon and the alternation of day and night and the wax and wane of the seasons, and those are just the really obvious factors.
Sure, yeah, and I mean, there probably will be more of these, or maybe more of these types of discoveries in the future. One of my objections to it is it goes back to this debate that astrologers have had for over 2,000 years now, which is, does astrology work as a result of the planets acting as causes do celestial movements cause earthly events to happen? Or does astrology work because the planets merely act as signs or omens of future events, which is kind of different? They're not directly causing things to happen. They're just mirroring or indicating what will happen for some weird sort of unknown reason through some explanatory principle like synchronicity or what have you. It seems like astrologers make a lot of claims about astrology, and astrology seems to be capable of doing things that, to me at least, don't make sense within a causal framework. And therefore, I don't see things like this as necessarily evidence for astrology directly. Like, it might be evidence that there's something that overlaps with astrology, but that this in and of itself is not necessarily astrology. It's a causal mechanism that's correlating with certain things, but to jump on this as evidence, of astrology seems a little weak, or a little jumping to conclusions, just because astrology claims so much more, like, than this in and of itself is evidence of. We just might want to be careful about that, but still, perhaps open to it in the future.
Yeah, it's a really weak case to say that that validates all of astrology. That's not a position that holds up to any critique, right? Because astrology just makes much more extraordinary claims.
Right. Yeah, I mean, yeah. And so that's an important point, actually, because that leads us to one major issue, which is the issue of astrology and science, astrology's relationship to science, and the issue of astrology and skeptics, or skeptics of astrology, and what the future holds when it comes to those things. I don't think it looks good, and I think this is one of the areas that there's going to be major problems as the skeptical community continues to become more organized and become more powerful and become more, what's the term? Like trying to actualize like their potential. And I think that because I can understand from a skeptic's perspective how they would think that they have the moral imperative to stop astrologers from what they're doing. And that's because if you take science as the litmus test, like current scientific understanding of the universe, as the litmus test for what's happening in reality and what is real versus what is not real. And if astrology does not, as it currently doesn't, have any great evidence that completely validates it, then from a skeptic's perspective, they're going to say that astrologers must not be doing anything that has to do with reality, or what they're doing must be false. And therefore, if they're doing that, and if they're practicing astrology, and if they're seeing clients or accepting money for it or what have you, that they're doing something fraudulent. And from that perspective, I can understand a skeptic's then line of thought, where they would think that they have some sort of moral imperative to stop people from being ripped off, or to stop astrologers from doing what they're doing. And that line of thinking to me, and I've been seeing this because the skeptics are becoming more active and becoming more sort of organized about doing various things against certain fringe groups. I see this as becoming a bigger issue for astrologers in the future that they're not really thinking about, but that will become an issue in the 21st century. I feel like that's actually a very minority viewpoint, though, because usually when I talk to other astrologers, they don't think this is a big deal. I think you're one of those guys that's kind of skeptical about my fear, I guess, of skeptics.
Well, I follow and concur with the entire line of reasoning you just laid out. I think that's solid. Here's the thing, in America at least, the recent rise of fundamentalist Christianity is so widespread and so politically active that I think that that's going to keep the skeptics, which are very tightly tied to and often synonymous with the atheists, busy for decades to come. I think that if astrology was this giant thing that the people were debating in public policy and was, you know, threatening to change laws, if it was that visible, I think absolutely the skeptics would go after us. However, because we're, in a sense, we're pretty small potatoes, politically speaking, I don't think, and there are really not that many of us who are full-time professionals, I don't think we're going to draw that much ire, which doesn't mean that it won't happen from time to time, but I just think that there, if you're thinking from a contemporary skeptics' point of view, they're much bigger fish to fry in terms of public action.
Maybe. I don't know. I mean, it might be the case that I focus too much on it, although conversely, it could be the case that a lot of astrologers don't pay enough attention to what the skeptics are actually doing and what their mindset is and what their operational procedures are when it comes to other groups. It's like I don't necessarily endorse some other things outside of astrology. I don't necessarily have any personal experience. I don't know if it's valid or not valid, but things like homeopathy or things like, just about every fringe thing that's sort of you know, deemed as not being valid, it seems like I've seen instances of it coming under attack by skeptics, either publicly or through other means. I mean, one example of this that's actually affecting astrologers now is that the skeptics are very organized on Wikipedia, and there's more skeptics who edit articles on Wikipedia than there are astrologers who edit it. And as a result of that, most of the most heavily trafficked astrology articles have a heavy slant against astrology on Wikipedia. So it's not neutral. It's not like an in-between. It's like most of the high traffic astrology articles, like the main one on astrology, if you read it, it's just every other section is just about how there have been objections to astrology at various points. Even when it's talking about it historically, it gives an abnormally long section to talking about historical objections to astrology from 2,000 years ago. That's like one of those examples to me where the skeptics have won, because virtually all the astrologers who used to edit articles on Wikipedia and who used to kind of do battle with the skeptics in order to keep the articles neutral, they've lost, and they've all had to pack up and go home, so that the skeptics have sort of won that battle. And I just wonder how many other battles like that there are, and at what point astrologers will be on the losing end. This actually came up recently where in the UK, the Prime Minister has proposed this porn filter, this filter for internet service that filters out by default pornography. And in order to, it's an opt-out service. So you have to opt out of it. You have to publicly say, I want to watch pornography or what have you in order to opt out of it. Otherwise, by default, all those websites will be blocked that have anything to do with that. And Wired magazine in the UK, they actually ran a story recently saying that there was a bunch of other subtopics that were also filtered in this default filter, and one of them was quote-unquote esoteric subjects. So that's like another one of those instances where things might become more difficult for astrologers. It's like, conversely, even though the internet is going to give us so much greater access to information and the ability to look things up, at the same time, there's like a crackdown in certain places. Like, you have the astrology articles on Wikipedia becoming slanted against astrology. You have the potential of internet filters blocking content or access to astrology websites. I mean, there's some ways in which the future of astrology looks very good, but you know, we shouldn't start, you know, dancing to the Age of Aquarius song at this point. Like, the Age of Aquarius is not going to dawn tomorrow and then everyone's going to accept astrology, but it's actually going to be, in some instances, much more difficult than that, potentially.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think some of it comes down to what your expectations are for astrology's public acceptance. You know, as far as having a poor reputation publicly, in terms of being, you know, in terms of how much truth people assign to astrology, you know, we've been in the dumpster for a couple hundred years. you know, when I got into astrology, it was in the dumpster, and, you know, culturally speaking. And so I guess I'm not so worried that people are publicly saying bad things about astrology still, because it's always been that, or, you know, in my brief, practice of astrology, that's been the case the entire time. I haven't been in any groups other than like very small gatherings of like-minded folks where people thought that it was a reasonable thing to be studying astrology. Sure. So I think to a certain degree, this is sort of par for the course. I do think that it will be interesting to see if that proposed legislation in the UK actually goes through. It specifically targets esoteric sites. And one thing that's interesting about the UK is that about its fifth most popular religion right now is some form of neo-paganism or Wiccanism.
Right.
Wiccanism. And that I know that community, which I would consider myself a part of, it's a pretty big banner, are up in arms about it, and that it's not, you know, 20 people. you know, we astrologers are very, there aren't very many of us, right?
Right.
And so I think it's unlikely that that'll go through. And that a lot of the heavy lifting legally, if it does need to be done, will probably be done by the, what we just call the pagan community, which outnumber the astrologers vastly and are much more organized legally.
Sure. I guess in terms of the astrology being a fringe group and being on the fringe of society and having issues, like earlier, we're talking about skeptics and the objections to astrology from scientists, and you brought up skeptics dealing with the skeptic / atheist movement, since the two have sort of coalesced into one, essentially, and them doing battle with the Christians. Although astrologers are in the unfortunate position of not just having objections from the scientific community, but also having to deal with and not certainly not being on friendly relations with the fundamentalist religious community of almost any denomination or of any branch either. So it just puts us in a weird position as a sort of fringe group in that way.
Yeah. Well, what's really interesting is if you look back at the various purges, what people call like the Inquisition, although there are many Inquisitions, and much of the activity that was that's portrayed as Inquisitional is actually secular law as well. I'm thinking about the series of witchcraft acts in Britain, for example, which forbade, basically forbade intercourse with spirits of any kind and any of the services associated with that. And astrology is sort of last on that list. And so back then, the people who got the full wrath of the church were basically people who were claiming to have relationships with spirits and to have to be able to perform magic of some sort or another. And yes, there were some, we have some stories about astrologers getting in trouble. John Dee, for example, gets in trouble for reading, Elizabeth's sister. She gets in trouble and put on trial for reading her chart. And I believe Lily got into some trouble as well. But both of those guys got off. We don't have these sort of mass persecution and burning stories. What this leads me to is that when it comes to the wrath of the church or churches, astrologers were on the list, but they were pretty far down it. And I would argue that that's kind of the same position that we're in relative to the skeptic atheist movement. We're the smallest fish to fry. And that's, I think, contributed to the historical survival of astrologers, is that we're rarely the biggest menace.
Sure. I guess just there's been some instances where that has not stopped us from problems. Like even a few years ago, remember the whole Zodiac controversy, and it's like things like that that really bother me, because they're really clearly like efforts at disinformation that are being falsely put in order to make astrologers look bad or look worse than they already do or what have you, like putting out this release of this story that suddenly takes off and every news outlet in North America, even around the world, is talking about it, saying that there was a new constellation or there's a new 13th sign that was recently discovered and it's completely thrown off the zodiac and astrologers are now wrong. And that's exactly how it was framed, even though the astronomers themselves knew that that was false. They knew that there wasn't anything that was recently. It wasn't like a sudden thing. Like astrologers have been aware of precession for 2,000 years, and they've been deliberately using, at least tropical astrologers have been deliberately using their specific reference point for 2,000 years now. And yet it was put out as this sort of piece of disinformation. And I still run into people every once in a while who remember that story from a few years ago, and they say, you know, didn't the zodiac change recently, or weren't astrologers wrong about that, or what have you? And I wonder what things like that do in terms of the long-term psyche of the public's view of astrology and understanding of astrology. I wonder if we will see numbers go up or go down in terms of interest in astrology in the coming decades, or interest in horoscope columns or sun sign columns or what have you. I tend to think, based on the trajectory that it's currently going at, that we'll see a decrease and a lack of interest in at least popularized forms of astrology. But I'm not really sure.
Oh, I think, okay, there's a lot of interesting stuff there. I was around for the Great Zodiac Controversy or whenever it was.
I think it was like 2010?
The hoary old days.
Right. And long ago.
I wrote a brief piece explaining precession in what I hoped was approachable language. And I think that was, I'd never gotten more traffic for a piece than I got for that one. It's such an easy thing to explain. You know, it's the problem with making a weak argument. Like, even if you can spread a weak argument everywhere, it's so easy to dismantle. And the person who made the weak argument then ends up with egg on their face.
Yeah, and that's true for almost all modern skeptical arguments against astrology, or at least most of them, is the skeptics themselves don't know a lot about astrology and therefore make weak arguments. Although astrologers have been resting on that for a while, and that's not going to be the case forever.
And I don't, I personally wouldn't mind a rigorous critique of astrology's claims about how reality works.
Sure.
I think more of us should be conversant with the implications of the material we're working with. I think that might actually be positive. Mm-hmm. You know, it's sort of like I'd like to see the skeptics actually critique astrology as it's practiced, rather than these ideas that really have very little to do with the practice of astrology now or in a past period.
Sure.
Now, one of the things, another thing that you said, I think brings up something really important historically, is you're talking about a possible decrease in the number of people who read or are interested in horoscope columns or various popular forms of astrology.
Sure.
And while we can argue that there are some popular applications of astrology in Renaissance and previous periods in the tradition, the printing press and then really the modern era, and I'm speaking of the historical modern era beginning sometime in the 18th century, saw the rise of astrological almanacs and then newspaper columns and then mass-produced paperbacks, like Linda Goodman's a great example. Mm-hmm. I don't know how much I think those have actually helped astrology. They have helped individual astrologers make a living and given them hopefully the time to pursue more serious studies. But I don't know that that astrology to succeed or to be strong and vibrant, it's necessary for astrology to have a horoscope column in every paper. That's something you can do with astrology. And as someone who wrote a horoscope column for 8 years, it's very interesting. It's an interesting challenge. But I don't know that we need that. Honestly, I would be very satisfied if we had a more serious, dedicated, rigorous core community that didn't extend out as far.
Sure.
I think that would be a terrible thing.
Well, that actually, that connects to a topic that came up recently on Facebook, which is the, not just the validity, but whether sun sign columns were helping or hurting astrologers. And I don't necessarily want to go too, because that actually would be a really great discussion on its own. And I wanted to make that like an entire episode. So perhaps I could have you back and we could talk about that next time. But that would be a really good topic. And I guess just the question, because, newspapers are on their way out. So there's no longer going to be like this, section that's reserved for some form of astrology, some form of popularized astrology. Yes, people can still get that online, and perhaps therefore the greater ability to access things like that, or even more advanced forms of astrology, like the transits that you can get on astro.com, on Astrodienst. Maybe that'll be good for it. I guess I just, in terms of general science, the way that science is taught and the extremely antagonistic and negative view of astrology that most people will get just taking a normal high school science course or astronomy course, and the sort of scorn and mocking that anybody would get from that, I feel like that's worse than it was in previous decades, and perhaps will lead to less people even considering astrology as something that's possible at all in the first place, or even considering it. And I can obviously understand that viewpoint, and I can sympathize with it, because astrology as a premise sounds absolutely absurd if you're not familiar with it and if you haven't looked into it and haven't seen it work in practice. I can understand how that would sound absurd, but I don't know. I just, in terms of the future and in terms of whether astrologers are going to have an easier time or a harder time making that pitch to the average Joe, I think they might have a harder time in the future as things progress rather than an easier time.
But that's a valid concern. I think that one issue that's tied up with this, so there's what's being said in a classroom. How is the scientific discourse behaving, right? But then the question, of course, is how much do people trust that discourse? And I think that one of the hallmarks of the period in which we live, which some people would say the hallmark of postmodernism, is that because there's so much information and so many points of view, people are becoming increasingly accustomed to holding multiple points of view or listening or being a receptacle for a variety of conflicting opinions and conflicting discourses. And that simply because something is being said doesn't mean that it's being absorbed and repeated verbatim. I think if you polled Americans about how much do they trust the conventional medicine right now, I don't know. It would be great to have a poll like that in hand, but I doubt that the percentages are going to be higher than they were 30 years ago. There's a lot of distrust for the sort of great Western institutions right now. You know, a lot of the economic ideas as well as the medical ideas have been problematized from a variety of angles. I think that's one of the many results of globalization, the internet being a prime engine thereof. So I just say that there's saying it, but then there's people believing it, and there's a gap between those two.
Sure, that's a fair point. And I guess that brings us to one of the last points that we meant to talk about, which is just one of the trends I think we've seen recently is in the astrological community is the ability to hold multiple viewpoints. And this issue with now that there's so many different types of astrology and different traditions of astrology and sometimes conflicting traditions of astrology, we're running into this issue where there's these two different options that people are often faced with, where you either you adopt a specific approach, which is the approach that either, you know, works best for you or the one that makes most sense to you, or maybe it's just the one that you learned when you first got into astrology and therefore that's why it's your preference, or what have you, where you just pick a specific approach, versus this other thing where sometimes people will say, well, you know, I do this, however, I acknowledge that there are these other positions that are valid or just as valid or may have validity as well. And there's like a bunch of instances where astrologers are going to have to make a choice between those two different options. And there's not necessarily one of them's not right and the other one's necessarily wrong, but there is going to be a choice in a number of different instances. For example, one that's getting debated a lot recently is the tropical versus sidereal zodiac issue. And the question of, you know, if I use the tropical zodiac, does that, and it works for me, does that by extension automatically mean that the sidereal zodiac is wrong? Or, do the tropical zodiac and the sidereal zodiac mean the same thing? Can they both work? Can they both have the same system of rulership? Does it make sense for them to both have the same system of rulership or the same qualities associated with each of those signs? Or other issues, like with house division. Like, if I use whole sign houses, does that mean that Placidus doesn't work? Or if I can use two different forms of house division at once, and is there an ability to synthesize the two, or is it really like a mutually exclusive thing? There's so many different issues like that in astrology where that seems like one of the things that astrologers are going to have to navigate over the next few decades due to this plurality of different traditions at this point.
Absolutely. And I think that part of that process is understanding when two claims are truly in conflict versus situations where they're simply revealing two different sides of the same object. I don't know if you're familiar with the old parable about the blind man and the elephant. You know, the one blind man grabs the elephant's tail, right. Another grabs its leg, another grabs its trunk, and you know, the guy who grabs its leg says, "Oh, it's a tree." The guy who grabs its tail says, "Oh, it's a snake." You know, etc. I think some of these techniques are, you know, are simply this kind of situation, and that by looking at them and comparing them, we actually have the opportunity to further define exactly what we're looking at when we use the tropical zodiac, or what exactly our whole sign, what angle our whole sign house is giving us on a person's life. Because when we can, in those situations where we can further define exactly what it does, then we know when to use it. One of the things that I've certainly thought a lot lately when I've encountered people who have who are more grounded in the depth psychology application of astrology, in looking at some of the technical differences between what they're doing and what I'm doing, I've thought to myself, huh, that seems really good. That seems like the perfect tool for that job. If I tried to use that tool for my job, I would fail miserably. But that doesn't mean that they're stupid and wrong.
Sure. And
like you said, I think, consciously developing that ability to say, I don't know exactly what they're doing with that. I'm going to investigate it. before just saying, well, it's not what I do. You know, it's not what I do, and it's probably stupid. Or it doesn't work for the purpose I have, right?
Sure.
If astrology is a tool, you know, a hammer and a wrench don't do the same thing, but one is not superior and the other inferior.
Sure.
And so I think just making room in the discussion for that is very helpful. I do think there's probably just some bad ideas out there,
right.
And I think we'll get to the root of that. But I think there are a lot of ideas that aren't bad. They're just good for this specific purpose. My hopeful Jupiter on the rising sort of perspective is that, with these various techniques in schools, fighting it out or dialoguing or both, is that astrology will become richer and more coherent over the next decade or so.
That sounds like a good sort of goal or end point to strive towards. So I guess we should start winding this down. Did you have any other major points about future things in astrology that you think are worth noting?
Yeah, I had a few. I'll be brief.
Okay.
One is, we talked about the impact that the Vedic tradition had on astrologers in America and the English-speaking world. Well, there's this other country that's not too far away from India. You might have heard about it. It's called China. And there are a lot of people there, and they have a Chinese astrological tradition. There are actually a couple different systems. And from what I hear from people who have spent time in China, Chinese and otherwise, culturally, divination, going to, a fortune teller, a diviner of some sort, never really went out of style. That it's something that's still done in a lot of forms. And so, I guess one, there's the what happens if we get some good Chinese astrologers, or astrologers, coming from the Chinese tradition who translate and present the material very clearly. What effect will that have? right? And then two, what about, you know, as every major business has been asking, every international business has been asking themselves for the last 15 years, what impact will the Chinese market have on what we're doing? I know that there are some astrologers. I know Stephen Forrest has been going and doing workshops in China, and they look like they're much better attended than the workshops in the United States. You know, it's a lot of people. And if it's a culture that, or if there are elements of the culture that end up being very receptive to what we're doing, or, you know, the variety of things that Western astrologers are doing, that may very well change things.
Sure.
So, I mean, I think that China is worth considering. Another thing that I think is important that I see happening and that I'm personally involved in is that in recovering the history of the astrological tradition, what you find is that it's riding shotgun with hermetic practices well over 1,000 years, or for several large periods. That there's a very strong interplay between hermetic magical traditions and astrology. The very tip of the iceberg being planetary magic, which is a sort of whole different angle on remediating a chart and remediation in general. I see a lot of people doing work in that area. The quickest and cleanest example of which being the translation of the Picatrix, which is an 11th century Arabic book, basically a planetary magic, of that being translated into English for the very first time ever in this decade, or in this last decade, by Ouroboros Press, and then by Christopher Warnock and Greer. And so that's that material has become available very recently, as has a lot of material. And I see that material and the implications of that material impacting a number of astrologers' practice, and my own included. And so I think that's also worth noting.
Yeah, definitely. As part of the revival of traditional astrology, the revival of traditional magic and traditional approaches to astrological magic and talismans and amulets. I think then what we've got here is the revival. It looks like our main theme that we keep coming back to is the revival of older forms of astrology and just the importing of other forms and other traditions of astrology, whether from India or from China or from far back in the Western tradition. And suddenly the practice of those techniques by contemporary Western astrologers today and the interface of those traditions with some of the modern approaches. And that seems to be the main thing that's coming in the next few decades. It's already happening. It's already in the process right now, because there's a bunch of astrologers running around who are practicing traditional and modern astrology at the same time and are introducing interesting mixes or interesting synthesis of those approaches. But it will be really interesting to see in the next decade or two decades, or maybe even three decades, what the result of that synthesis actually is. And if anybody is able to successfully pull it off, like if the result of all of this, the revival of all these traditions, is the synthesis of, or the creation of some new form of astrology, or if you just get a bunch of different traditions sort of running around that are practicing their own unique approach, sort of independently of one another, and that they don't really have any access points. So you get this sort of fragmentation of the tradition rather than seeing it come together.
I think we'll probably see something in between. It'll probably shake out to a couple schools, maybe three.
Should we place bets on what those schools are? This is being recorded, so I don't know if you forgot, but they'll be able to hold us to this in two or three decades if anyone's still listening to this show.
I think we done a pretty good job covering what ingredients the schools will have. I don't know exactly how it's going to shake out. I can't say that I know. I think that the Vedic tradition, there will certainly be for the foreseeable future, a very distinct Vedic tradition. You know, it has very deep roots culturally and has been around for a very long time. There may be offshoots and admixtures, but I think there will still be like a very traditional Vedic astrology in 40 years. Mm-hmm. I think that the evolutionary astrology movement, being probably the newest of those that we've talked about, is probably going to absorb a lot. I think they're probably going to end up absorbing ideas and techniques from a variety of places before that stabilizes. I think that's still growing and kind of becoming whatever it's going to stabilize as. I guess here's a question, I guess primarily for you, Chris, is when we're looking at what people call Western traditional astrology, and we look at, let's say, the medieval period, medieval European period versus the Hellenistic period, do you think that the traditional community will stay coherent as sort of from Petisiris to Lilly, or do you think that that will fragment into were the Renaissance people, were the Arabic phase people, were the Hellenistic people?
Right. I don't know. That's difficult because I always see, you know, I did that study on the Uranus-Neptune cycle, which is about every 160 years or so, and every time there'd be a conjunction, there'd be this revival of older forms of astrology, and they'd get synthesized together with whatever the newer forms of astrology or the contemporary forms of astrology were, and then that would create a new tradition. And it was just this never-ending process of transmission and synthesis. And but it's hard to say because, you know, that looking back in the past, we don't see all of the texts surviving. We see the texts that were the most influential surviving. And oftentimes those are the ones that best represented some sort of synthesis and what came out of that synthesis just before that time. So, but it's never clear like how much the old guard sort of stuck around or how much of those that refused to adapt to the times or to whatever the new astrology was. Because it's like first century BCE, you've got, for example, these Babylonian horoscopes written on clay tablets that don't have the ascendant or houses or probably aspects. And that goes all the way until about 50 BCE. And then all of a sudden they just drop off and they just disappear out of nowhere. And then at the same time, out of nowhere, this other form of astrology, Hellenistic astrology that used the ascendant and aspects and houses and everything else and transits, just the charts begin at the same time out of nowhere, and then it just completely takes over. So it's kind of like that, where sometimes I really think that you have, you know, other forms of astrology, but then suddenly something new comes along and it completely displaces the old tradition. But sometimes it's in a way that it builds on top of it, and it's not that the old tradition just disappears entirely. It's just that it gets assimilated or it itself assimilates some of these new concepts and techniques that are introduced, and then everything's different going forward. I kind of see that as where we're going at this point, just because just looking at things like the use of whole sign houses amongst a wide variety of different people, it's not just traditional astrologers who are doing it. There's like psychological astrologers, there's evolutionary astrologers, there's, you know, just about everybody adopting whole sign houses. And that gives me some indication that it's possible for things to completely change all the way across the tradition very quickly and to completely displace what happened prior to that.
Yeah. No, I think that's really interesting. And one of the things that leads me to is if these movements, if these grand synthetic and translation movements can be pegged relatively reliably to the Uranus-Neptune cycle, then I would expect some really interesting things to be happening when we hit the first square.
Yeah, I'm trying to remember when that is. Do you recall offhand when the first Uranus-Neptune square is?
I'm looking it up right now.
I am also looking. It looks like it's many, many decades into the future. Something like around the late 2030s, early 2040s.
Yeah, they're square by sign and close in the late 2030s.
Okay, so that's when it starts then.
Yeah, yeah. And then it's well into the... they'll be square by sign, looks like, most of the way through the 40s. So if that is any indicator of the timing, it might take a while. Or perhaps it will be on the waxing sextile when we get something something approaching synthesis. But I guess, so apart from, you know, the Chinese or the Vedic tradition, I guess the question is, will there be a workable and popular synthesis between what we call modern Western and pre-modern Western?
Will there be a workable synthesis? In some instances, there can be, because things like whole sign houses, it's just like a switch, and in some instances, you can use both at the same time. There's other areas, though, that it's more difficult. Like, the rulership thing is tough because...
Absolutely. You either use rulerships or you do not.
Well, you use rulerships or you do not. And then, you know, whether you use Neptune or Jupiter, for example, as the ruler of Pisces, or whether you use Mars or Pluto as the ruler of Scorpio, makes a huge difference interpretively. And I know that there's some people like Alan Oken, for example, in his book... Rulers of the Horoscope, that was published about a decade ago, who advocate using like a system of dual rulerships. It's tough because if you, there's some techniques that really require you to use one system or the other. And I feel like in some of those instances, people are going to have to come down on one side, and I'm not sure which direction that's going to go.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and there's also, there's I guess what it looks like at this point is that modern astrologers are grafting certain aspects of traditional doctrine onto what they're doing. Because like you can read a horoscope with a psychological focus with whole sign houses.
Right.
I also think that you can take sect into consideration from a psychological angle, the difference between day and night charts. And what you're doing with it, if you're looking at it from a psychological angle, is not the same as what a traditional astrologer might be doing. But there may be a psychological dimension to a traditional division between day and night charts.
Right.
So I think for the next decade at least, it's going to be a lot of experiments and a lot of hybrids. And some of those mutants will thrive, and some of them will shown to be non-viable.
Yeah. And that's going to get hashed out, and then there will just be... I'm looking forward to seeing... I hope I get to see the one text that, like, synthesizes it all together, because I think there'll be, like, one text or one school that does it, and then that'll just become, like, the popular thing that most people... Because, you know, like, a lot of people... everybody has certain astrology textbooks in their library, and that's, like, their main go-to text. Like, it's, like, Planets in Transit, for example... That really established Robert Hand's career. And like everybody knows, Robert Hand is like one of the greatest astrologers in the world. And it's primarily because of that text. And he's influenced, you know, many generations of astrologers. And then there's other texts like that. Like William Lilly's text is influencing like tons of traditions over the past two or three centuries. And then William Lilly himself was drawing heavily on Guido Bonatti. Sometimes there's just like somebody writes a textbook, and it's often contains their own personal synthesis of a bunch of different pieces of the earlier and contemporary traditions. And that just happens to be the one that catches this sort of zeitgeist or the astrological feeling of the era. And that's what gets transmitted, or that's what becomes the standard in future generations.
Or Ptolemy.
Yeah, Ptolemy. Well, Ptolemy's funny because we don't know if Ptolemy... We think, at least a lot of people think at this point, that Ptolemy innovated his own system, that he took some parts of the earlier tradition, but then he completely reconceptualized it in what, in his day, was a scientific theory of astrology, that the planets literally physically cause things to happen on Earth through emitting different levels of heat and moisture. And he completely reconceptualized early techniques and basic technical doctrines around that.
Yeah, So one thing I want to point out about Ptolemy that I think is to add to what you're saying is that he doesn't necessarily represent the mainstream of what astrologers were thinking at that time.
Right.
But those are the books that people read. You know, those are the books that the Arabic astrologers read. They read a lot of Ptolemy. They didn't necessarily have Valens, right? And that sometimes, I don't know, it just brings up a lot of questions about what gets remembered and if it was necessarily the best thing, you know, or the most masterful take on astrology, or if it's just how it shook out.
Yeah, that's a really good point, that Ptolemy became the most influential text ever in the history of astrology, but that Ptolemy's astrology itself wasn't a continuation of the earlier tradition. It was something very, very new. It was like more of a new innovation. But later astrologers looked back to Ptolemy, and because Ptolemy's text was one of the only texts that they had from that period at the time, they often assumed that Ptolemy was what astrology looked like back in that period. Yeah. So there was these periodic, like in William Lilly's day, like these periodic efforts to go back to doing what Ptolemy was doing, even though what Ptolemy was doing was never part of the mainstream of the tradition until much later. So that could happen for us today. That's like the modern day example is if somebody like, I'm trying to think of like a polymath, like he's not a polymath, but like Neil deGrasse Tyson, if he like suddenly wrote a book on astrology, but it was like from a more scientific perspective, and he stripped out a bunch of things about astrology that he didn't like, and then that became the popular text for like the next century or a few centuries. That would be a good example of what happened with Ptolemy.
Yeah, or if an anthropologist from the future is looking back at the 20th century, and they're like, "Wow, this Linda Goodman's sun sign book is way outsold everything else. This is probably what people were doing."
Yeah, right. Or somebody grabbed one of the Uranian astrology books and used that, and it was like, "Wow, astrologers really dug these hypothetical planets and used them pretty frequently." I guess we never did come back to Uranian astrology, but maybe we'll save that for another show. Okay. Well, I think unless you have anything else to mention, I think we'll wrap up this 2 hour and 16 minute discussion on the future of astrology.
No, I am an empty bucket, my friend.
Okay. Well, thank you for sharing your wisdom and perspective with us. Your website is austincopic.com, and if people want to join you next week for the pre-conference workshop for the Association for Young Astrologers, that takes place on what day?
That's the 14th.
Okay. August 14th. August 14th in Philadelphia, and it's what, $40 to attend?
$40 to attend. All the workshops are $40. You should choose us.
Excellent.
We have a smorgasbord of great young astrologers who are there to offer a variety of really intriguing viewpoints on a lot of the things that we've been talking about in this discussion.
Excellent. Well, people can find out more information about that at your website, on the IA website, which is youngastrologers.org, or you can go to the NCGR website, and I'm sure you can find out information about it there. So thanks for coming on the show, and I'll definitely have you on next time, Austin.
Well, thank you, Chris. It was a lot of fun.
All right. Well, thanks everyone for listening. I guess that's it for this show. Remember to subscribe to the show by email. If you go to our About page, you can find out how to do that. If you enjoyed this episode of the show and you listen to it through iTunes, then please be sure to go through and rate it and give it a 5-star rating on iTunes. That'll really help us out. And please let us know what you think of the show, and let us know what future things that you think are happening in the future of astrology, what currents and what things that perhaps we discussed or didn't discuss would you add to this discussion. So that's it for the show, and thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.